Hello, Emily Wright.
Good morning, Sam McClary.
Should you say good morning? Because by the time this goes out, it's probably not morning anymore. But anyone can listen to it at any point, so maybe it will be right.
If you're listening to this in the morning...
Good morning.
Good morning. If you're not, I'm really sorry if we've completely confused you and now you don't know which way is up and which way is down.
Yeah. So...
Check your watch or your phone.
Yeah. Do people wear watches anymore?
I was just thinking that.
Yeah.
Oh, God, even for us, this is peak rambling before we've even started. What a waste of some lovely new equipment.
Absolutely. So we've got these big arm things with dangly microphones on now. So
if our head of production could, not head of production, multimedia editor, could hear you say that, I'm sure he'd be absolutely shocked. These big arm things with dangly bits.
Well, I didn't say dangly bits.
Yes, you did.
Dangly microphones. we'll tweet a picture of them, you can see. But we should get down to business. Now you've got me going because we've talked about dangly things.
Dangly bits,
dangly
actually. So we should probably say that because of this new equipment, we're allowed to bring drinks in. And yeah. Not that we're drinking alcohol, but I have got a coffee with me. And anyone who's been an avid listener of Tech Talk Radio will understand that if there's caffeine involved, then things tend...
Before we've got one interview this week, haven't we?
We do, yes.
And before we crack into that, and people who listened to Friday's extra special Tech Talk Radio would have had a sneak peek as to who we have in the studio this week. But let's have a little update about what's going on with all things tech at EG. So obviously, coming up very soon now, we mentioned it last week, is our first Tech Talk Live.
Yes.
And we have some... So you talked last week that we've got Alex Price, who's going to be there talking about
Palmer
how
Capital.
To hire a CTO. Anyone else on the lineup?
Yeah, we have Arup's new CTO, which should be really interesting. So he will be joining the panel. So the morning will be the panel discussion. Then we've got Alex Price of Palmer Capital, as you mentioned, and their new head of innovation, which is a really interesting hire, actually. I can't give it away quite yet, but if you check out the website for the event this week, it should be up there. So they'll be talking about that 18-month period of, you know, should we have a CTO or a head of innovation or whatever it is, and the whole hiring process. And then we're going to be having a keynote as well. There'll also be somebody joining from CBRE as well. Again, really sorry, can't reveal that quite yet, but we'll be able to reveal it this week. I think that it will be great to have quite a few different voices, both from inside the industry and outside the industry as well, because as we know, the property industry, whilst actually this year, particularly the end of last year, making great strides when it comes to digital transformation, hasn't always been its strongest suit. So when it comes to CTOs, I think it'd be really interesting to hear from somebody who's in that field from outside the sector. So yes, that's on the 1st of March. Really looking forward to it. And it will be 8 a.m, nice and early.
Oof,
indeed.
I'm hoping there's breakfast.
There is breakfast.
And coffee.
And coffee. Yes, breakfast, coffee and networking. And it's 8 a.m. until 11 a.m. But I think that the actual proceedings finish around 10, 10:30. So.
Great. And if people want to find out more, then it's egi.co.uk. And we'll put a link straight to that page in the show notes for anyone. So do have a look and hopefully we'll see you there.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you're from the property side of the industry, obviously it would be great in terms of masterclass from Alex on how to hire a CTO, and the panel discussion obviously as well. And if you're on the tech side of it and you know, want to know how the property companies are handling the change and becoming much more practical in terms of that, then also one for you too.
Excellent. And so let's move on to this week's interview.
Yes, let's.
So who did you talk to this week, Emily?
The ever opinionated, in a good way, Neil Usher. And for anyone that's been to our what used to be Offices Summit and is now our Office and Workplace Summit, will know that he is he's a regular at that event, for very good reason, because not only is he you know, at the peak in terms of workplace design. As I mentioned last week, and anyone who knows him will know, he was the design brains behind Sky, and Sky Central is the area that gets the most coverage, although he sort of made the point in our conversation that there was a lot more to it than that. And he has a way with words which is just so brilliant, and he doesn't pull any punches. He tells things exactly as they are. So we were chatting around the future of workplace, both in terms of tech and non-tech. And I think the most interesting thing for me, although of course it was all interesting, was how he was saying that, as far as he's concerned, the next evolution of the workplace, if you sort of strip out all the tech side of things and just look at it in terms of how it operates and the aesthetics, is that the workplace, whilst should never go back to being boring, and he said, you know, if you look back to the 80s and 90s, people were, crawling out of offices at the end of the day, barely living still because it was such a depressing place to be. So we should never go back to that. But he said that the workplace of the future and the workplace of the present is really much more grown up these days. That's what he's trying to achieve anyway, and that the workplace is not a playground.
Well, let's have a listen.
This is a bit of a change to normal proceedings. I'm normally interviewing or questioning Neil Usher on a stage somewhere in a cool, trendy central London venue, but today I'm joined by the property workspace and change professional. That sounds very proper and formal, doesn't it?
It does. It's a little harder to describe yourself when you're not in a sort of straightforward corporate role.
Anyone now listening to you and hearing your voice will know that, of course, I am joined by you today in the Tech Talk Radio studios in a not so trendy workspace, I'd argue. It's our own workspace here at EG. I don't know how we feel about it, really. You've had a wander through. You had a quick look.
I've been here before.
What do you reckon?
Doing the EG Awards. It's been fine. We've got daylight.
Fine.
We've got daylight. Fine's all right for now. We've got daylight. We've got a view. We did bring our own tea, though, so I'm not sure what that says.
Yeah, well, it says you're very wise. So thank you so much for joining me. You've had a really exciting 25-year career, and the last 5 years of that have been pretty amazing, working for Sky. The Sky Central scheme, obviously the pinnacle of what a lot of people would consider to be an excellent workplace. You're the man behind that. So let's start with that, I think. You've got all kinds of exciting things coming up, which we're going to talk about, including a book. But let's just go back before we go forward. That workspace, what makes that different and by default so successful?
A little bit of a step back, if I may, just before that, because I think it sort of might make some sense, is that when I was at Rio Tinto, I spent a lot of time in Australia. I saw a lot of the activity-based workspaces that the sort of large banking institutions, financial institutions had put in place, and used to sort of wistfully think, if only someone would do that in the UK, will I ever get a chance to do something of this interesting, of this scale in the UK? Which was then when the Sky project came to my attention. It wasn't just a Sky Central project, it was a transformation of its whole workplace portfolio. Sky was a sort of roughly a 25-year-old business at the time. It's very common these days to say that a business operates like a startup, but it genuinely had that sort of energy, but its workplace was in some need of a transformation. Sky Central was the sort of probably the most publicised end product of that, but there were a number of other projects that preceded it that we learned from and developed from there. So I think it's safe to say probably that a lot of that learning and the learning on my sort of travels before that and a lot of experimentation before that, whether that's through Honeywell or earlier days through Warner Brothers or PolyGram, plus the sort of learning in Australia and the research on my travels all sort of came together at the right time in the right place. So I think it was a bit of an alignment of the planets, really, in terms of where I was at in my career, where the opportunity lay, and it was just down the road. I used to walk to work, which was quite nice too.
That's always a bonus. I'm as you've gone back a little bit before Sky and Sky Central, I'll go back even further. Then it's a bit of a game now. what is it or was it about the way we work and how important that is, and the aesthetic and the, you know, the ease of which people can move around a building and make a building work for them. What was it about that that first piqued your interest and then led you down this long and lustrous career path?
My first role in this business was having just completed a master's in IT, strangely, back in sort of 1991, was as a facilities manager at Warner Music. It was a distribution centre that doesn't exist anymore, in the days when we did actually used to distribute vinyl cassettes, if anyone remembers those, and CDs as well. And it was a really sort of full, deep learning curve, really, in terms of facilities management. The centre there, about 80,000 square feet, had offices, it was a unionised distribution environment as well. So you got a grounding in everything. And I think even in those days, I was really made aware of just how small changes in the provision of the workplace created a beneficial outcome. The sort of reactions from people, the ease with which people were able to do their jobs, and their sort of motivation, really. And I think even from doing the sort of small scale projects in those days, it was sort of using a local builder, and I was the whole professional team all on my own. Sometimes someone from finance used to assist, but it was on a very small scale. But I think the early seeds were sown then, really, in terms of sort of the contribution we can make. Most property teams are very small within their large organisations. The impact they have and the ability to touch people's lives beneficially is quite remarkable. And I think there's very few functions in an organisation that have that.
You mentioned there the small changes that can really change a working environment or change the way that people feel when they're at work. What are some examples of that, the small changes? Because I know that people tend to be quite aware of some of the big things that can be done, but if those small things make all the difference.
Even now, I usually say to people, look, fix the technology first, then fix the toilets, then fix the coffee. And if you can do it in that order.
Technology, toilets, coffee.
Yeah. The second and third of those can be very small changes. Generally speaking, it's interesting with toilets, and we talk about this quite a lot, really, in our circles. But they're one of the few spaces that the visitors to your building will visit. They usually come into a meeting room, or in this case, a radio studio. But they might see the reception, they might see the meeting room that they're brought into. They never really see the workspace, and then they see your toilets. We have to sweat the small stuff. It's the small stuff that makes all of the difference. We move very quickly from the sort of macro aims of a project right down to what it means for me personally. And if we can just make sure that we touch on those small changes, the locker being big enough, the somewhere secure to put my stuff, the cup of tea or coffee that I get being of a decent quality and easy to come by, and a sort of visit to the washroom being a pleasant one, then I think, you know, we're well on the way. It's not as grandiose as it's often made out to be. And I think that's really the grounding in facilities management that brought that to bear. I was at the coalface. I was sort of dealing with a lot of these issues on a day-to-day basis. You know, how crispy was the toast in the restaurant in the morning, those sorts of things. I used to have to negotiate the sort of prices in the restaurant with the trade union representative and those sorts of things. At Warner Music, one of the most important things that was negotiated every year was the Christmas present. These are the sorts of things that really made a difference, and you could see the positive impact of all of that. So I think sort of starting in FM really helped, and I often say that my career really is a sort of anti-clockwise journey around the property clock. So I started in FM, got involved in sort of more and more sort of bigger projects, proper professional teams and more grown-up projects into sort of transaction management and property strategy. So I think the sort of starting from the inside of the kitchen cupboard and working out was a beneficial way to do it.
And how do you feel about the kind of the movement and the force, if you like, behind the importance of the workplace, workspace, office, you know, people call it different things, that we've seen come about recently? You've been in this industry doing what you're doing for 25 years. It does feel, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it does feel like over the last 5-6 years there has been this sort of like real ramping up of everybody wanting to get in on the office, the workspace, and everything that entails, and whether that is as a result of what the tech companies are doing, or the fact that, you know, social media and the fact we're more connected means that we have much more access to see what other people get in their offices. But Is that something that you think has been a good thing for the evolution of the workspace?
Absolutely. I think this is a really good time for workplace. I think this year could be massive in the workplace sector. We've been banging the table for a long time, saying to organisations, you must take your workplace seriously. I've been fortunate enough to work with organisations that generally have taken the workplace seriously, and some of that's been as a result of sort of lobbying internally to make sure that happened, and also a desire to do that on the part of management as well. But I think that we also are suffering a little bit with having banged the table for so many years, and now it's being taken seriously, having a little bit of a resource gap and a little bit of an ideas gap as well, in terms of it's sort of finally we're being taken notice of, and actually are we ready to respond to that? And I'm not entirely convinced that we are. I think we're getting there and getting there quickly. But yes, you can't spend an idle day trawling through the internet without coming across, you know, top 10 coolest workplaces in the world, or you know, the perils of open plan, or some sort of commentary about workplace. There's more content out there than in the last sort of 2-3 years, and I think there's ever been probably in all of the time put together before that. So it's very much in people's minds, for sort of positive reasons and positive benefit. I think now we have to harness the industry itself and actually have to respond to that and have to try and make sense of it all. Mm. We see the same ideas, the same things often repeated. We're not very good with critical thinking. We tend to sort of, I'm always saying there's just sort of bandwagons rolling all over the place. We sort of get run over by them on the way out and then get run over by them on the way back when they prove not to have been quite as sort of what they were made out to be in the first place. So we get sort of pancaked twice, really, and it's time to be a little bit more critical with some of those ideas for everyone's benefit. But I think right now it's in a great place. I think I just hope that the industry harnesses that and takes that forward and doesn't let that fantastic position drop away or fail to respond to the opportunity.
Let's talk about that fantastic position in a bit, but before we do, let's talk about those bandwagons rolling in and out and all over the place and causing mayhem as they go. The bandwagons you are referring to are, for example,
the biggest one of all that seems to be rolling over the other bandwagons at the moment is well-being, wellness, whichever we tend to use those two terms interchangeably. I think they're slightly different, but generally most people understand them that way. I think there's a few concerns with it, really. I think there's sort of everybody's jumping on the bandwagon. There's a bit of a race to the printers to be the first to sort of publish research into this. We don't have a lot of good critical research behind us. But I think we see with this probably more than any other bandwagon that's been rolling before, the lack of anyone at all actually challenging whether this is the right approach to take or the right thing to do. I think the industry generally at the moment takes criticism like that as being a little personal and just sort of doesn't embrace critical thinking in the way that perhaps more mature professions have got their head around and become accustomed to doing. I don't think anybody disputes that a workplace that enhances well-being is a good thing, but I'm not necessarily entirely sure that the over-provision and the over-focus on well-being is something that we want to embrace. There's something about being left to make our own decisions and being left to be human beings from time to time that might need to be addressed.
And arguably, you know, well-being does come down to the things that you were mentioning earlier, those simple things, the toilets, the coffee, that kind of stuff, just making people feel comfortable and that they have what they need at their disposal.
Yeah. And I said in the book, and we'll come on to that, I'm sure, but if you provide a healthy option in terms of your food offer, but someone wants to eat a pie, then they're going to eat a pie, and there's no amount of information you're going to give them or cajoling that will stop them eating a pie. And if they don't want to go to the gym, they're just going to walk right past it or not bother to join. I think sort of forcing people down the route of healthy eating, forcing people to exercise, is not necessarily where we want this to go. And I think it's about making sure that the provision is balanced and that we give people some space and we actually allow people to make decisions, even if from time to time, and that they're what we might regard to be bad decisions, but people still need to be respected as humans and still need to be allowed to be a little random from time to time as well.
Okay, I'm just going to say a few things at you and I would like your instant reaction to me, please. Sitting is the new smoking.
I can't stand that expression.
I knew you wouldn't be able to stand it, which is why I put it to you.
Probably the biggest load of rubbish that's been spouted in workplace in the last decade. It's just completely and utterly rubbish. I think, you know, there have always been issues around prolonged sedentary positioning, and, you know, for many years, as long as I can remember, we've encouraged people to get up and move around, and that's really what we want people to do, is to be a little more mobile, if they can be. And for some people, they won't be able to be, but for the majority, they can be. I think having the option to stand is fantastic, but to be as sensationalist as to suggest that somehow the harm you're doing to yourself, and the harm in particular you're doing to others around you, is equated to smoking is ridiculous. I don't think anyone's ever sort of coined the expression sort of, you know, kind of passive sitting at the moment, so the person next to you is suffering from the fact that you're sitting down. It's part of that sort of tendency towards sensationalism, with a complete lack of critical thinking underlying it.
Okay, one down. serendipitous interactions.
Yes, another one that's often talked about. Something I think we struggle with a little in dealing with the physical workplace is genuinely understanding the interaction between the physical and the digital workplace. About 5 or 6 years ago, I decided not to belong to any professional bodies and to use social media as an opportunity to build a broader network. So I sort of left the BCO and Cornet and BIFM and all the things that I used to belong to, because I got sort of very aware, really, that I was talking to the same people about the same things, and it was quite insular. And I went on this little journey to see if I could do this for free, just taking part in the gift economy, so giving back as much as I was receiving from others, and going on this sort of just meander, really, being random, just sort of. And I went to the Tuttle Club, was probably the most interesting of the groups I went to, which was a gathering organised at this place called the Centre for Creative Collaboration in King's Cross, which was one of the very early incubator centres for new businesses. You've probably seen PaveGen on your travels. Mm-hmm. And PaveGen started in the centre when there were like one or two of them. And
really? We've had Lawrence on this podcast.
Yeah, Lawrence was there with a few people. We used to occasionally pop up and see Lawrence, and he used to ask us, do you prefer this one or that one? And we'd all sort of take part in that. But that was just a couple of hours every Friday morning. People from all sorts of walks of life and all sorts of professions and businesses. And I found that what was happening was we were generally all in sort of looking at the same issues, but just from a different standpoint and a different angle. So I now have networks within the sort of community, the sort of digital community, the HR community. I've made a lot of personal friends through this. In the days, if you remember Twitter, when virtually nobody in our industry was ever had an account and was ever taking part. And we used to be sort of trying to encourage people to get involved, because you'll meet some really interesting people out there. So I think the serendipity that I've found is far greater in the digital sphere than it is in the physical sphere. Using enterprise social networks properly within organisations gives organisations an amazing opportunity to create knowledge, to share knowledge, to connect people across the globe in real time, that really need to be looked at, far more so than people bumping into each other in a corridor. Okay. But by the same token, I've also spent quite a lot of time working with agile engineers. So not agile workplace, but agile engineering as institutionalised in the last 20 years, capital A, capital E. And the way that agile engineers work is the more digital their working day, the more analog space they need, and the more they need to physically be in the same location. And they're sort of living, breathing examples, really, of the sort of serendipity that occurs. One of the projects at Sky that I finished just before leaving was an agile engineering centre of about 1,000 people, which had Now TV and a number of the other software development teams in it. We built about 65 Scrum walls, and we basically, instead of trying to sort of force agile engineers to work in a more corporate way, we built a space that was entirely based around the way they work. And they got a huge amount out of that in terms of the serendipity and serendipitous encounters that they weren't getting in previous environments. So in some fields, I think it's still really vital, but I think that one of the things we need to look at exploring more within the workplace community is just a deeper understanding of what goes on in the digital workplace as well.
Great. I've got a couple more for you. Okay. Space as a service.
Got to be careful because I'm sure Anthony will be listening. Anthony, I think space as a service is fantastic. You know,
this is
I'm
Anthony Summers,
it.
Of course, if anyone was in any doubt.
Yeah, you know I agree with you entirely, even though I might rib you from time to time.
First person you thanked in your book.
He was, yes. He was very helpful and read it for me in advance. So, and Anthony and I have always had a good sort of debate about this. And having spent some time at a place like the Centre for Creative Collaboration, and I wish it had a shorter name, was that I got to see sort of incubator spaces in the almost the sort of pre-digital sort of days, really, because these were businesses that were doing all sorts of things with technology, but they weren't all sort of tech startups per se. They were startups across a whole sort of, you know, raft of different spheres. But this was very much early days flexible working. They used to organise jellies. People sort of don't tend to use the term jelly anymore, which was basically people who were freelancers or individuals all working in the same space from time to time. Because
I thought you meant they actually arranged jelly.
It wasn't real jelly.
What a shame.
The idea, I know, it probably would have gone really well with it. But the idea of the jelly is probably sort of 6-7 years old, started in the States. Really just sort of bringing lonely freelancers out of the cafes and things and out of home and into a space where they could all work
into
together.
Into their trousers, presumably.
They all got dressed and came in, most of them anyway. So I think that, you know, these were the really early days of space as a service. These were the early days of people working together in spaces on a slightly informal basis. I remember going to the first hub space, which was in Angel. And I don't know if it's still there, but it was in a really sort of dingy space, but it had an open fireplace, recycled cardboard desks, all these sorts of things. And you couldn't just go and rent space in the hub. You had to be a member. You had to give something to the community as well as taking something out of the community. So I think space as a service, as an idea, has been around for a long time, really. These were the early seeds of it. I think that landlords, space providers do need to be very service aware. They do need to make sure that they're making the experience in a workplace as positive as possible. And I think for sort of smaller and medium-sized organisations, I don't think they're really co-working centres anymore. I think the sort of flexible workspaces we have now are doing a fantastic job. If it's making one contribution, I think, above and beyond everything, it's bringing service to the fore. It's making sure that we understand that this isn't just about building a space. It almost completes the circle for me, really, right back to starting in facilities management, because that was all about service. And I think that the workplace industry, and in particular the sort of the more strategic elements of the workplace industry, need to understand that you don't just need an agile workplace, you need agile technology at the heart of that, and you need an agile service provision. And sort of a focus on service is what's going to attract people to the workplace and keep them there. Working life has to be simple, easy, intuitive. Everything has to work. Everything has to be there when you need it. And if that space is a service, then it's absolutely the future.
Oh, there you go, Anthony. He'll be pleased with that. And this last one is a bit mean, because I know how you feel about it. And you articulated it so beautifully at our recent Workspace Summit. And when I say it, I don't just mean this thing in isolation. You'll know what I mean. It embodies a lot of things. It's the table tennis table.
I can safely say I've not actually played table tennis in the office ever. I think some of the sort of toys like table tennis tables and slides and climbing walls and those sorts of things were important in the journey and in the development. They were important because they enabled us to think differently about workplace. And a lot of what we do is about legitimization of ways of thinking and ways of practicing. So putting in a table tennis meeting table means that you're actually saying, look, a meeting table doesn't have to be the way you think it is. Where do you actually like the representation of that, whether you actually think that a table tennis meeting table is a good thing or not, it's people saying it doesn't have to be this way. And if you think about sort of the last 30, 40 years of workplace provision, for many decades, it was really dull. It was really boring. It was the same sort of day in, day out. If I think about even the early work offices I worked in, they were just dreadful. They were soul-destroying places. You sort of crawled out on your hands and knees at the end of the day in complete misery, because they were just such dreadful places to be. And you'd usually come out of a great school or a university where lots of things were happening that were filled with energy, filled with life, and you came into these dreadfully sort of, you know, soul and energy sapping spaces. So they're important. The table tennis table, whilst I might sort of, you know, take the mickey out of it from time to time, it's been really vital on our the development of our understanding.
See, now I didn't, I don't know how you feel about it. I was expecting a completely different answer.
There you go, there you go.
I think you said, is there anything more annoying than the sound of a tennis ball going
back
and forth?
No, the sound is, yeah, it's the sound. I don't know if you've ever seen, there's an episode of Veep where the vice president visits a West Coast sort of, I think it's a bit of a mashup of some of the larger digital organisations, but she's trying to have a sensible conversation with the managing director and two people playing table tennis in the background. She turns around, will you shut up? I've had to move table tennis tables and football tables out of workplace because actually, as background noise, they are incredibly annoying. But I think, you know, all of this, whilst I'm not a huge fan of the kind of, you know, the playground in the office, I think it's been vital to our development and it needed to happen.
And while we're on the subject of the tech companies and the corporates mirroring some of the tech companies in an attempt to woo graduates and making sure that they're offering something fresh and exciting, there's one school of thought that might say that's great. There's another school of thought I know that Despina Katsoukakis has said before, you've got to be really careful of taking the Google concept and then just rolling it out and rolling it out and rolling it out, because that was right for Google. It might not necessarily be right for a different company with a different ambition. Some people might think it's somewhere in between. Based on what you just said about the table tennis table and all that it represents and the evolution of the workspace from something dull, dreary and soul-destroying into something new and exciting, and hey, it doesn't have to be this way. What are your thoughts on that? Do you feel like it's been a, you know, not just looking at the table tennis table, but looking at that whole sort of the Google, the Facebook way of thinking and the way that it's filtered from the West Coast through. Do you think that's a positive thing?
It's interesting that the Googles and Facebooks of this world have had the most attention, really, because actually I think the financial institutions in Australia, and let's face it, before that it was a Dutch insurance company that in Interpolis that actually had, that actually was the most radical of any workplace scheme for many years before it, if not sort of ever.
I'd be interested to find out how many people listening to this podcast would have been aware of that.
Yeah, it's so some of the schemes that really have landed and really have stood the test of time are those not associated with the big West Coast tech companies. But the tech companies, I think, realised very, very clearly that it was part of their brand. It was part of their sort of digital representation of their business, and was a differentiator, and so they publicised it very heavily, and they made sure that everybody knew about the slide and knew about the cool funky workplaces. I think what's portable is the thought process, it's the development of ideas, it's the courage to do something different if that's right for your organisation. It's not the end product that's the portable bit. And I think sometimes a lot of people mistake that. It's how did you arrive at that? That is the really vital part here, not what you arrived at. Mm. So it's the why and it's the how, not the what. But we focus on the what because it makes a nice picture and it gets circulated and it appears in the top 10 coolest workplaces in the world, which if you've noticed never have any people in them other than maybe one or two friends of the photographer. but you know, the fact here, I think, is that that it's the courage, it's the process of arriving at that being right for your organisation. So copying Google, if you're not Google, is probably going to get you into some hot water. It's a dangerous thing to do, unless you've arrived at the process that's right for you too. So you could actually arrive at that for the right reasons. You could go through the why and the how and arrive at the what as being completely valid, and it might have a lot of those characteristics. But you have to be prepared to be critical. You have to be prepared to really think long and hard about what it is you do want to arrive at, and go through that sort of open-ended and sort of experimental thought process to get there. So I think they've gifted the world the ability to think widely about workplace. It's quite interesting. A lot of these companies now are starting to tone that down. They're starting to look at one of the things I'm sort of very proud of at Sky is it's a very grown-up space. Yeah. It's got a spirit of fun about it and a spirit of sort of there's got an adventurousness about it as well. but it's very timeless. The way it's an adult space. You know, we built a workplace for grown-ups, and I think it will stand the test of time as a result of that. So I think that, you know, I'm starting to see a lot of that now coming through, particularly with the sort of domestic influences that are creeping into workplace design as well, that we're starting to look at this being a little bit more than just a sort of an instant dopamine rush and something that might actually be something we'd still quite like to come back to in 2 or 3 years' time.
Do you think as a result of that we'll sort of stop seeing quite so much exposed brickwork and industrial chic and filament light bulbs and black paint?
Now you're really getting into stuff I don't like.
I know.
I
said I wouldn't ask any difficult questions. Yeah. I lied.
I was thinking I got away with it now. One of the things that I wrote a post about, sort of 5 hopes for workplace this year, a few days ago. One of those is that we just be a little bit more independent spirited in terms of our sort of approach to design, and we don't just follow trends relentlessly. Just about every restaurant, cafe, workplace at the moment is sort of based on this, what I usually call workshop chic, which is just, you know, almost like taking a perfectly comfortable, decent interior space and then sort of, you know, chipping off the plaster to reveal the brickwork and slinging the worst example of it to me is the filament light bulb, and it's the dangly flex, you know, where it's suspended in a different part of the ceiling from where you actually wanted it. But I do notice that with a program that's been on television very recently, McMafia, there's a lot of interest in the interior design in this program, because it's moved quite heavily away from the sort of the workshop chic that we've been used to seeing. And started to gather a lot of interest. So we might be into the next trend, might be a sort of McMafia interiors, which are very much sort of more opulent, much warmer, much more comfortable. I just hope people maintain some independence of thought. I think that tools like Pinterest have probably actually been counterproductive. They probably were productive for us at one stage, but the complete immersion of basically being able to find anything you want within about 5 minutes, I'm not sure is a good thing anymore. I think it actually dampens our creative spirit. I think it actually sort of works against creativity. I challenged a designer recently. I said, look, you know, I want you to design this space, and I'm not going to allow you any access to Pinterest or any of these other reference points.
And how
can
did
you
that
do
go?
This? Absolute horror, you know, blood draining from face, as in, I can't do that. Because it's you know, if I think sort of 10, 15 years ago, it was a real slog. We had to go back through magazines and, you know, and really work hard to try and find reference points that would stimulate that creativity. It's everywhere now. It's completely immersive. So I'm thinking it's sort of slightly dulling the creative edge, if you like. I think people just need to sort of go back to a more inner creative spirit to be less guided by trends.
Did the designer eventually do what you asked?
We didn't do that particular project in the end. It was I think in this business we probably sort of end up working on 1 or 2 out of every 10 projects we ever initially talk about, and it was one of those that didn't see the light of day. But I've not lost the thread or the thought, and at some point in time in the future I am going to do it with someone where they are literally just with white paper and pens. And we'll take it from there, and we'll see what happens.
Well, let us know when you do. So from the last few years spent at Sky, and obviously we talked a bit about what you were doing before that, now it's the era of Work Essence and sort of consulting, that's right, isn't it, and bringing all that expertise together. But not just in that sort of consulting style, there is a book, and it will be out on the 1st of March.
That's right.
Is that right?
Yep.
So I'm just double checking. Yes, The Elemental Workplace. Great title. Could you talk us through what it is that you cover in that? And I know there are the 10. Sorry?
12.
There are 12. Yeah. Oh, so close. I did read it as well.
There were 10 originally. And when I did a lot of this and a lot of the research in terms of sort of focus groups, I realised a couple were missing, so it became 12.
Okay, so for the benefit of the listeners and me, having said 10, what were the original 10, and then what were the 2 that were added?
Oh, now you're asking me. Can I just give you a little bit of a story leading up to this?
You may,
if I may. I'd always sort of had it in mind that I'd like to take the blog that I've been writing for about 6 years into a long form. But in this sort of, you know, I thought, well, with leaving Sky, I've got the time to do this. So I was talking to the publisher. I said, so can I have this around about November? Published pre-Christmas? And they said, no, it takes 6 months to release a book from submission of the draft. I'm sure Fire and Fury was released a bit quicker than that. But it takes 6 months from submission of a draft the publisher accepts to actually have the book published. So I thought I was only going to be consulting for a little while. And then when they said it was going to be March, I was like, okay, so plans had to be slightly revised. So I wrote the book and probably took about 6 weeks. And then it's taken 8 months in total through sort of the various editing processes. So the message really is it's a lot harder than I thought it was going to be. And it takes a lot longer than I thought it was going to take. And you do go on quite an emotional journey to get to that. You have some fairly sort of intense moments and a lot of nights where you can't sleep because it's pinging around in your head. And sometimes you just can't write it quick enough. So all the ideas are there. It's like you just physically can't get the stuff out on paper quick enough. But it's been fantastic, and I've loved doing it. So I've been consulting and advising in the meantime. I'm doing most of my work with Unispace at the moment, which has been fascinating as well, because they're a sort of fast-growing organisation who have a fabulous sort of challenger spirit, which I like working with people who have that sort of mindset, everything's possible, and still advising on a sort of freelance basis as well. So still doing some other work too. So it's been quite an interesting model. There were a few times during the summer where I sort of woke up in the middle of the night and thought, oh God, I haven't got a job. What am I going to do? A few little sort of scary moments, but it's been fascinating. I've learned a huge amount. Writing the book, you learn quite a lot about yourself as well, and your own sort of.
What did you learn about yourself?
You have to learn a lot of patience and your own sort of ability to organise your thoughts, really. I've tried to, I started with a structure, but still got caught up on the structure and on sort of innumerable occasions. You learn sort of levels of tolerance and sort of you learn how much you can write in a day and, the sort of the extent to which you can actually sort of keep thinking. And I have to say, during the editing process, there have been so many times where I've sort of had a cold sweat and gone back and thought, what did I say there? And sort of, revisiting it again and sort of rewriting it again. So some really interesting sort of steps along the way. But delighted to have finished it. I signed it off for printing last week.
Congratulations.
It's gone off to the printers today, I think. So.
And what is it that you are hoping to, hoping to achieve a lot having written it, but what is it that you would like, the mark that you'd like to leave having written this, having put those thoughts down on paper and people, before too long picking up this book and reading it, what do you want them to come away with?
I've tried to create something that is in its own way as timeless as possible. I'm sure the technology bits are going to be out of date fairly soon, but I've tried to keep those relatively loose. I've tried to create a framework for thinking about why we need a fantastic workplace, sort of how we go about delivering that, and the elements are really about what that consists of. So there are no case studies in the book. There are no photos of workplaces in the book, which I think a lot of people might find slightly surprising. A friend of mine illustrated it. So there are some cartoons, but there are no pictures of workplaces because those sorts of things date stamp a text very, very quickly. It's probably got a shelf life of about 2 years if you include too many pictures of case studies, because there'll just be new ones, fresh ones, every year. So, and I've tried to write something which isn't applicable to any particular location, any particular work style. It's just as applicable to a sort of traditional one-to-one environment, private offices, as it is to an agile or an activity-based workspace. I don't think there's any dependence on particular culture. I don't think there's really a dependence on a particular budget either. So back to the whole reason for writing it in the first place was the belief that, and it sort of brings us full circle from some of the things we were talking about at the start of the conversation, which is that this is very achievable. We tend to complicate, we tend to find reasons why we shouldn't do things rather than reasons why we should. So I think it's quite possible to have a fantastic workplace by focusing on some very, very simple ideas, some very simple things. There's still a significant role in this for design. The workspace still has to be designed. The usual sort of processes that we would go through with a workplace project still have to be undertaken. But hopefully it's a framework that if we follow this framework, then we've got a pretty damn good chance of success. And really it was, I guess it was sort of frustrations from an early point of view with the fact that the large tech companies were kind of hogging all the publicity, getting further and further away from the reality for most people. And we get quite London-centric, we get quite sort of, you know, we focus very much on the organisations to get all the publicity that appear in all of the top 10 coolest workplaces lists. And we forget that the vast majority of people work in pretty mundane and pretty uninteresting environments still. And whenever I sort of do an initial show of hands with a group of people, if you ask people, you know, who's working in a fantastic workplace, you get few hands show up. Who's working in a terrible space, you get a few hands show up. When you ask, you know, whose workplace could be improved, just about everybody puts their hand up. So we're in this sort of normal distribution type of situation, really, where for most people it could be better. So why isn't it better? And I think there's every possibility of using this framework to try and improve the workplace for everyone. Because really that's why I love doing what I do, and that's why I've stayed in this business all of this time, because I've been aware from the very early days of working with my local builder and painting people's walls and those sorts of things and improving the coffee, that actually our ability to positively impact people's lives is very real, and it's something that's a gift. You know, we should really be doing as much as we possibly can in our roles to improve people's workplace and improve people's day-to-day environment. And you know, we're not investing in the asset, we're investing in the people. And that is an interesting mindset shift for a lot of people, is that don't think about what we're spending on the building, it's what we're spending on the occupants of that building. That this is all about.
Great. Well, so the Elemental Workplace, available from the 1st of March, and people can get hold of it.
I've got a website hopefully being launched at the end of this week, which gives a sort of synopsis of the book and shows you where you can buy it. It is on Amazon already, as someone pointed out to me at Christmas time. I've tried to make it affordable as well, so it's a very easy to read. It's £12.99, so it's not an academic book, it's not a great big business tome that you'd use to sort of prop a door open with, and I've tried to make it as entertaining a read as possible as well, so it keeps you going through it.
And what's the website people can visit?
It's elementalworkplace.com. It's being built at the moment. I've been told it will be ready by the end of this week, and that will just be a very simple site which just tells you about it and gives you a link. Until that's up and running, I haven't really done a lot of sort of promotion on it or a lot of marketing, but I will be fairly soon and hoping to get the word out. It's on a global release as well, so I've wherever I've mentioned square meters, I've put square feet in brackets. So I'm hoping that it's is sort of globally applicable. An organisation spelt with a Z as well. So there's sort of elements of it that hopefully make it applicable across the world. So that's the idea.
Great. And before we let you go, not off the stage this time, but out of the studio, there are just a couple of things that I wanted to touch on quickly. And one of them is this concept of that we've discussed in the past, actually. And I know that you have thoughts on it because you've written some thoughts down for me for one of our upcoming publications. But this idea of, you know, are there any ideas left when it comes to workplace, and how much further can we go? What are your thoughts on that for the benefit of our listeners?
I think at this moment in time, we are struggling a little for sort of new ideologies and new ways. I think those lovely black and white photos that appear in a lot of people's presentations from sort of, you know, the 1920s of everybody sitting in rows with typewriters. Realistically, I think a lot of people would say that the open plan workspace sort of came and then disappeared and then came back again. We've experimented with sort of private offices, and we've experimented with cube farms. We've experimented with agile or activity based workplace. There's only so many ways that you can actually arrange people in a space and that you can make that work. I think the technology underlying all of that will slowly take over in terms of being the dominant force and the dominant influence in a space, in terms of the way that we are arranged and behave in that space. But I think we're always in search of something new, and sometimes it's a recycled idea. But I think we're sort of, I don't think we've really perfected agile workplace. I don't think we've really understood it deeply enough. And for that, I mean activity-based workplace as well. I think there's more to go with that. And I think that I'd probably rather we focused on how we create agile workspace or a balance between agile and more traditional forms, because most workplaces are a sort of hybrid. They're very rarely the pure delivery of a particular ideology. Mm. I think we just really need to focus a little bit more on the present and a little bit more on getting that right before we start inventing something new. But it is quite interesting that the last real sort of paper on this, the last real ideology, if you like, dates back to 1985, which was the original paper on activity-based working. And so there really hasn't been anything since that has had that the same ideological impact. And I think we're constantly looking for new ideas, new labels. For a lot of people, it's a market differentiator, and I get that. But actually, there's still a lot more work we can do with just getting the workplace we have today right, and just making sure that we really understand the process of change. Even that, I address that in the book, that we shift our thinking from adoption to adaptation, and we borrow some ideas from the digital sphere in terms of effectively and successfully managing change. It's not all about the next term or the next ideology. It's about actually just, at the end of the day, it's about improving people's experience in the workplace. That's why I've tried to keep the book as simple as possible. And I know there may be some who find it too simple in that sense. But realistically, that is what it boils down to. So I think I'd probably caution against people sort of getting too carried away with trying to think of what's next. We're still making sense of the present, and there's still a lot more work to be done there.
Okay. And then the other thing I just wanted to touch on was the role that developers play in all of this, slightly specifically, and in that I interviewed, I quote this a lot actually because he's the only one that said it to me, but I wonder whether it's a wider trend. I spoke to Norman Foster following on from the Apple HQ building, and he said that he would much rather talk to the client direct, he'd much rather talk to the company rather than go through developers, and he thinks that there's a great link between the designers and the architects, and he referred to the entrepreneurs themselves and the tech companies, I think he was referring to in that instance, and that they're leading the charge whereas developers just follow. What are your thoughts on that?
Something I've sort of advocated in sort of talking to people about their careers for a long time, and I'd like to see a little more of, is a lot more fluidity within the business as a whole. I'd like to see more people with occupier experience working for developers. I'd like to see that going back the other way. I'd like to see sort of more designers with occupier experience, and again vice versa. I think that in the same way potentially that our ideas of space are breaking down, I think if we can start breaking down the very rigid delineation of what you do, then I think that's going to benefit everybody. Mm. It's been very interesting working with Unispace as an occupier, and sort of being on the inside of a design firm, because I've sort of wanted to do that for a while, and so it's been some of our discussions are fascinating in that sense, because we're helping each other's perspectives. I think the best thing that could be done really is that instead of an architect feeling that they'd rather have a conversation with an occupier directly rather than a developer is feel that they're actually talking to someone who gets it, who understands it, who has a broad base of experience. So I think the more that we can start breaking down the professional silos, and the more that we can start seeing a lot more fluidity, I think collectively we are going to develop much more thoroughly, organically, and much more quickly. There's a sort of, I guess, a slight scepticism about sort of the profession going straight to occupiers. It's fine on a certain scale. I think as the scale diminishes, I think that becomes less practical. It's fine when you're dealing with an Apple and they've got a significant amount of money to invest and they're creating something sizable. I think that's fine. But I do think at varying levels, certain elements of experience are needed. And very often, if it's the first time the client's ever done a large-scale redevelopment like that, I think that they need to surround themselves with people with that experience. If that's a developer, then fine. If it's not, then it doesn't really matter sort of what their label is, as long as they have that experience. So my hope really is in the next sort of 10 to 20 years is that we have a broader workplace profession with people who've spent time in all of these different sectors, and that we grow our understanding together, rather than sort of locking ourselves away in those particular professions and those particular silos. And that's going to benefit everybody. Most importantly, it's going to benefit the people that we create the space for.
Great. And finally, the book is written, done, out in on the 1st of March. What's next for you? You'll have less sleepless nights, I imagine.
Yeah, it's been a sort of slightly empty feeling the last few days. It's like, I don't have to go back and do another edit. I can't now. That's it.
No, well, if you want to, then it's a bit late.
Yeah, I daren't open it at the moment, just in case I find something that I sort of got wrong or I shouldn't have written. I've got the next book planned in my head. I haven't actually written that out.
Can you give us a bit of a?
Yeah, I think there's a few books in there. What was quite interesting was I originally got asked for about 25,000 words, and I wrote 50, and it's survived as 50, which has been great because I sort of pretty much wrote as little as I could to tell the whole story.
Yeah.
And that feels like the whole story. And I can remember writing various things thinking, my God, there's a whole book in this, you know, that I'm just scratching the surface of this idea. It opens out into this whole other field. I think there's the possibility of an elemental guide to the brief, which is probably still the most sort of undervalued and underperformed part of our whole process, is getting that brief right. I think there's a space for an elemental guide to service. We touched on that earlier in terms of the importance of great service in an environment. I think that could be a whole book. But probably more importantly than all of that, I think there's another level sort of down really from this book. And I'll try to keep this one simple, but I think there's, in terms of just basically how to set up a whole workplace project, I think in really practical terms, all the sort of tools we deploy, I think there's a scope for creating almost a workbook, which would, if someone didn't really know how to do this, that they could literally just sort of follow that, and they would get a broad-based understanding of how to do this. So I think they would sort of start with the elemental workplace, and then they would move on to the sort of, you know, the whatever I end up calling it, but the practical guide to actually doing it. I've probably given it away, so anyone listening is probably rushing off to go and write that now. And I mean, one of the things I've probably lived in slight fear of really through the whole writing of the book is that the sort of the rug gets pulled and some sort of you know, everything that's in there gets published elsewhere. I'm almost over the finish line now. I'm just hoping that nothing happens in the next 4 weeks.
I'm sure it'll be a very quiet 4 weeks on that front, and we'll all look forward to picking up the book on the 1st of March. It sounds like it's going to be elemental, the series, so
I'm hoping so.
Look forward to hearing much more from you, and thank you so much for coming in and joining me today, and I'm sure I shall meet you on a stage somewhere in a very cool workspace, as we said, workplace with exposed brick and filament light bulbs very soon.
We can
with
do
someone
a full
playing table tennis in the background.
Yeah, absolutely. Wouldn't that be ideal? But really, thank you for the invitation. Really enjoyed it. Thanks
not at
a
all.
Lot.
Thank you. So that was Neil. And I think that the idea of the workplace not being a playground is an interesting one, and one that he quite rightly sort of caveats by saying it doesn't mean you have to be, you know, in a space that's uninspiring and boring. But let's not lose sort of track of the fact that people go to these places, yes, to not feel terrible at the end of the day, as was previously the case, but they're there to work.
Yeah,
so
you've got a job to do, haven't
absolutely.
You? You're not there to play foosball and run around a running track all day.
Yeah, and you know, he's
unless that's your job, maybe.
Yeah. Well, if it's your job, then arguably that's what you should be doing. Yeah. It's quite hard work doing that stuff.
But all day.
All day. But you know, he made the good. He was very diplomatic, actually, and made the point that the table tennis tables and the foosball tables have their place in the design evolution. He put it much better than I did. They allowed people to question the aesthetic of a workspace, workplace. They allowed people to think, well, it doesn't have to be, you know, boring. There, you know, we don't have to work in this particular way, but that despite the fact they have their place, the sound of a table tennis table is really annoying,
really,
and
annoying.
Not necessarily conducive to getting any work done. So more that they had their place as part of the evolution of design than the fact that they are a fantastic idea.
So we put a call out last week through our chat with Metaprop that we would like to hear from more startups, more young innovators There will be more of those coming up in future tech talks. We are lining them up. But if there is anyone out there who does want to be part of the show, do get in touch with us. You can email either Emily or I on our personal emails, or there is a tech talk email as well, which is techtalk@egi.co.uk. But we really, really, really want to hear from you.
Yeah, and we want to hear from you for Tech Talk Radio. We want to hear from you if you're interested in any of our Tech Talk Live events as well.
Absolutely. But for now,
it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me.